Over the next 5 Sundays, we're going to be engaging with parts of 2 Chronicles as we explore some lesser known kings from the Old Testament together, and as we follow the promise that God made to his friend David, that out of that family would come a truly wonderful king who would bless all the nations of the world. Before I jump into today's passage, which you'll find in 2 Chronicles from chapter 17 through 20, I just want to give us a bit of history around the passage. As you see, God's people haven't always had a king. When God used Moses to rescue the Hebrews from their years of slavery in Egypt, the families that had moved there had multiplied into 12 pretty sizable tribes. It had gone from a very big family to a small country in its own right. As the people left Egypt and following the conquest of Canaan, the land God had promised them under Joshua, this land was portioned out amongst these 12 different tribes or mega families who, for the most part, got on with each other fairly well and kind of looked after their own affairs and kind of ruled over their own individual borders. We see from the book of Judges in the Old Testament that the Israelites never quite finished conquering the land they were given. Instead of driving all of the Canaanites out before them, we see that they start to accept their religious practices as their own. They start to forget about the God of their fathers. And there's this kind of 300-year cycle of God's people forsaking God, ending up embracing Canaanite practices, being subdued and oppressed by the Canaanites, crying out to God for help, who sends a rescuer. And this kind of happens about 12 times over about 300 years, where we see every time they get freed, they turn away from God again, but God never turns away from his people. And it's in this pattern of forsaking God only to be rescued by his faithfulness that the people ultimately express their desire that they don't want to be ruled by God according to the covenant given to Moses at Mount Sinai, but they want to be ruled by a king like all the other nations around them. I don't know whether they had fear of missing out or just wanted to be like the other countries and have a king. Maybe practically it's easier to listen and obey someone who you can see and tangibly see where they live. So maybe they wanted a physical person to focus on rather than God in heaven. But whatever their reasons, God lets them have a king. But he never gives up on his people or his promise. And he ultimately ends up guarding his own people from the very worst behavior of their kings that they've asked for. Saul is the first choice. I'm sorry if you know this, but maybe you don't. Saul is the first choice. He's a man loved by the people because of his height, strength, and good looks, which sounds like a crossover between a general election and Love Island or X Factor, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like a good reason for picking a leader. Saul starts well, but when push comes to shove, he's unwilling to rule underneath God, instead preferring to do things his own way. His inability to lead in line with God's leading loses him his kingdom and ultimately his life. And he's replaced not by the tallest, strongest, most handsome man in town, but by a shepherd boy. A youth who's booted out to the hills to look after his dad's flock. But he's someone who's described as having a heart after God's own heart. David is seen as the poster boy for Israelite royalty. He's a fierce warrior. We see that he's a wise leader. We see he's a man of the people. He's loved and he is a devotee of God and his word. But he isn't without flaws. He falls short on a number of occasions, but he always turns back to his friendship with God. His son Solomon succeeds him and Israel prospers like never before. Solomon seems to drift, however, from following God to following whatever hedonistic pleasures take his whim at that time. He dabbles in architecture, horticulture, art. He has a seemingly insatiable sexual appetite, multiple marriages, hundreds of concubines, and then he starts to accept the foreign gods and practices of his many wives. And as the king drifts, as we'll see in the Old Testament, the people drift. The shepherd, who's supposed to guide the sheep, leads his people astray. It's under Solomon's son Rehoboam that the nation, God's people, split into two separate countries, with the nation of Judah in the south and the nation of Israel in the north. The northern kingdom falls very quickly to idolatry. Violent dynasties overthrow one another in short succession, utter godlessness, and ultimately that entire kingdom is destroyed. Judah in the south doesn't always fare much better. Of the 20 monarchs who follow Solomon, a handful of them are good kings. Many of them are bad, and some are downright ugly. But it's out of this family line of David that Jesus, God's ultimate king, is promised. Today, we're looking at the life of a man called Jehoshaphat. And I'm going to have to say that name an awful lot of times in the next 10 to 15 minutes. It's a name that hasn't really resurfaced in the whole give your kids a biblical name thing. There's not many Jehoshaphats running around in my kids' schools. I don't know, maybe it's time for a revival. He was around 35 years old when he ascended to the throne of Judah. He ruled for 25 years, and he is spoken of favorably both in 2 Kings and the passages in 2 Chronicles, which are much further, much more expounded. He's in chapters 17 through to 20, which is a big chunk of 2 Chronicles. I don't have time this morning to read those 3 chapters with you, but please do, if you've got a Bible on your phone or one in your lap, find it. Put a bookmark in it, read it when you get home, read it as we go through. I'm going to kind of do a bit of a whistle-stop tour looking at this man over the next few moments. I've already kind of said that it's not an uncommon image in the Old or New Testament to see leaders characterized as shepherds. While King David had grown up as a shepherd, he was praised for the way that he tended and cared for his flock, the people of God, while he ruled over them. But he was also chastened and rebuked in shepherd-like terminology. After murdering Uriah because he slept with his wife, David is described as being like a greedy man slaughtering and devouring his poor neighbor's only little lamb. While the kings and queens of Israel and Judah ruled their respective nations, and their orders and desires being carried through by their people, they were ultimately stationed by God with the purpose of shepherding his people and were judged by that criteria alone. Some of them were very successful kings, phenomenal building projects, times of peace, times of plenty. But when God looked at them, he didn't see good kings. He saw godless people who led his nation astray. We can learn a lot of good and a lot of bad from looking at the lives of these men and occasionally women. As a church family, we've started a new phase as Emmanuel Baptist Church. We're in our pastoral vacancy. Mark retired a fortnight ago after many faithful years of church leadership here at EBC. So we're starting a process together as a family of looking at where we are as a church. We're going to be looking at what is important to God in Swanage and the kind of things that our church should be engaging with. As leaders, we've gone through sort of Mark's job description and portioned out the areas that he was covering, but ultimately we're going to be hoping that God sends a leader to us at Emmanuel. Some of you might already have started thinking about the kind of minister you think EBC needs. Or if you're a visitor, you might have spent some time thinking about the kind of minister you've got and whether they're the kind of minister you think you need. Now, we're not looking for a king as a church, one all-powerful person who will do church for us and tell us what we need to know. We're looking for a shepherd, someone who will encourage and enrich God's people and his purposes. We can learn an awful lot about good church pastoral ministry from looking at the lives of the kings that we'll be looking at over the next 5 weeks. There are moments where we see glimpses of what really good pastoral leadership should look like. There are also utter car crashes where people make mistakes that echo on for generations. There are times where we can really blow it as leaders. But ultimately, what I hope we'll see as a church is less of a list of wants that we think God's next minister should be like, but more we'll see what God commends and God sees as faithful leadership. So I want to look at three things as we look at Jehoshaphat. Firstly, he's passionate. It's been said that any organisation is only as passionate as the top leader wants it to be. That applies to banks, theme parks, countries, and it also applies to churches. Whoever is at the top leading an organisation, as passionate as they are about a subject, or about their customers, or about not giving refunds, or about everyone having a really good time, that will filter through. And in chapter 17, we see that Jehoshaphat is a passionate follower of God. He pursues his own personal relationship with God. We're told that he obeys God's laws himself, and it's out of his own personal relationship with God that he sends out officials to every part of his land, Judah, to all the towns, to teach his people what it means to be in a covenant relationship with the living God. You might think this is the Bible, this is what we'd expect, but actually Jehoshaphat, as the fourth king of Judah, is a shining beacon in this regard. His father Asa had started well but finished badly. Other kings before him hadn't really followed God wholeheartedly or at all. But Jehoshaphat is seen to be proactively encouraging his people to return to the God of their fathers and forsake the pagan practices, the Asherah poles, and the Canaanite shrines that are kind of bled in and intermingled with the Jewish faith. He's not only seen to be educating his people, but he's also seen to be removing negative influences. So he teaches and encourages, but he also protects and removes distractions and the insidious cults that started to sweep through his country. And because of these characteristics and this passion, we are told that the Lord is with Jehoshaphat. God is with this king. So he's passionate. We're told that he's personable. In chapter 19, we see that despite being the king, Jehoshaphat leaves his palace and his city of Jerusalem to travel the country, encouraging the people to return to the Lord, the God of their ancestors, himself. So in chapter 17, he sends out his officials. In chapter 19, he goes on a tour of his own country himself, visiting towns, encouraging his people to worship their God. Now, I'm sure that there are a great many things that go into running a country. And for a king to disappear, to go on tour, to visit his people and tell them how good it is to know God and to encourage them to return to him, must have taken a bit of logistical work behind the scenes to make sure the other jobs and areas were covered. I'm certain that running a country is probably a lot more work than running a church. But as we look at good leadership quality, something we see in Jehoshaphat that the Lord seems impressed by is that he clears his schedule and hands over areas of responsibility so that he can be with his people. He's not locked away in an ivory tower. He's not in do not disturb mode. Sometimes he is. But at other times, he makes it his mission to personably see his people and encourage them. So he's passionate, he's personable, and we also see that he creates leaders. Good leadership, and bad leadership for that matter, often trickles down, doesn't it? If the boss isn't bothered, why should I be? Okay, if the manager doesn't turn up on time, why should the staff? Okay, good leadership and bad leadership trickles down. And as Jehoshaphat travels on his tour, everywhere that he seems to go, he appoints judges in the towns and judges in Jerusalem, the capital, in order to sort out civil and religious disputes. Jehoshaphat isn't a one-man band. He can't do it all on his own. He knows this. So he surrounds himself and chooses other people of good character. And he doesn't just delegate jobs to them. He creates leaders. Now, what's the difference? Well, if I give you a job to do and you do it, it's done. Okay? If you give people a job to do, you've created followers. What Jehoshaphat does is he creates leaders. He gives them a role and they are to fulfill it. He's not just delegating his work, he's creating people in areas to look after those areas, and he trusts them to get on with it. He chooses them, he equips them, and he gives them a couple of things to do as leaders. In this chapter 19, we see that there's a few things that he's really passionate about. The leaders Jehoshaphat wants are people who are accountable to God, not men. They care more about what God thinks than what people think. They're to be people of integrity and honesty. They're to do their job fairly and not take bribes or be pressured and persuaded by others. We're told they're to be courageous in their roles. And ultimately, their chief concern is righteousness. Isn't that a job description for pastoral leadership? People who care what God wants. People who have integrity and are honest, even when it costs them. People who are courageous and will see the role through, even when it's hard. And ultimately, their chief concern is theirs and other people's righteousness and relationship with God. So three things that Jehoshaphat does really well. He's passionate about God, and that exudes through the kingdom. He's personable, he's available, and he appoints and creates leaders. Just quickly, it's quite interesting when you see Jehoshaphat's name in lists of genealogies of Jesus or in annals of the kings, because actually he is quite exceptional amongst his peers. He's a very different king to his father. He's certainly a different king to his son and those that follow him. And basically his name is normally in the middle of a list of murder, sin and idolatry. And then we get Jehoshaphat and a few others who stand out well. And I think what this tells me is actually, regardless of what your family background is, you're responsible for your own relationship with God. And this is really good news for some of us. Because actually some of us don't come from Christian, God-fearing people. Actually some of us, we haven't grown up knowing the Lord all our life. And that actually we believe in a God who changes people, rescues people, and gives us fresh chances. It also means, however, that sometimes as parents or as leaders in churches, businesses, families, schools, wherever we find ourselves, our good leadership doesn't always rub off on those who are meant to be following us. So the negativity of our family or our leaders isn't inherited by us. We can change. We don't have to be the same as them. But actually, just because we're doing a good job doesn't mean those who follow us will. There's a very old English theologian called Thomas Fuller who wrote these words. Lord, I find the genealogy of my Saviour strangely checkered with four remarkable changes in four generations. Rehoboam begat Abiah. So Rehoboam, his son was Abiah. A bad father begat a bad son. But Abiah begat Asa. A bad father had a good son. Asa begat Jehoshaphat, a good father and a good son, and Jehoshaphat begat Joram, a good father and a bad son. I see, Lord, from hence that my father's piety cannot be entailed, inherited. That's bad news for me. But I see also that actual impiety, my flaws, is not hereditary. That is good news for my son. As fathers, mothers, as leaders, and we are all leaders of some area of influence to some extent. We might not be leaders of churches, leaders of businesses, but we are leaders amongst our peers, our friends, our families. There are people who look at you and follow you, whether you like it or not. So all of us as leaders can do better than we have been shown. There's a challenge. And the warning is that also all of us are capable of doing worse than we have been shown. Evil is not inherited, but nor is piety. And this is true in church leadership. All of the leaders we see in the Old Testament are flawed people, some to the extreme, some in rare moments. There are some kings who seem to do so well but blow at other moments. There are some kings who never seem to do anything right and then come back to God at the last minute. But all of them, because of their position of leadership, have an effect on their people and their people's relationship with God. Did that mean that the everyday people of Judah were exempt from moral culpability for their actions? No. They're responsible for who they follow, God or the king. And that's the same for all of us. We're responsible to follow God, Jesus, first and foremost, above any other leader. And we should be leading others closer to Jesus, first and foremost. That's whether we're parents, whether we're friends, whether we're teachers, whether we work, whether we're retired. That's the mission. But our family values, what have we inherited? Are we working towards what God is interested in? And lastly, what do these passages show us about when godly people do godless things? What does it look like when a man like Jehoshaphat, who's described as a good king, someone who God is with because he's passionate about him, what does it look like when he makes mistakes? Because Jehoshaphat gets it wrong. He gets it wrong in the same area three or four times. He seems to have a bit of a blind spot. He keeps making relationships with the family across the border, the royal family of Israel, who at the start of his reign is a guy called Ahab and his wife Jezebel, who are bad news. And we see that Jehoshaphat decides that it'd be a really good idea to marry his son to Ahab's daughter. Mistake. Absolute mistake. He's then invited to Ahab's for a feast and ends up agreeing to go to war with Ahab to try and take back a city that had been stolen by their mutual enemy, the Arameans. This again is a mistake. Ahab suggests that he disguise himself in regular soldier clothes in disguise, while Jehoshaphat rides around the battle in royal bright colours. I don't know how he convinced him to do that. That is a mistake. If someone's saying, I'll wear camouflage and you wear this orange jumpsuit. Now, I really don't get this either, because we're told in Chronicles, I knew you said Kings, we're told in Chronicles, Jehoshaphat has plenty of wealth, so he doesn't need to be impressed by Ahab. He spent the first 3 years of his ministry shoring up his army and the defences so that Ahab and the Israelites can't attack those in Judah. So he doesn't have to fear him. So why does he get so involved with this king who, as a family, massacres God's prophets, has led Israel into worshipping Baals and false gods and sacrificing to them? Ahab, who we're told is so wicked, becomes family with Jehoshaphat, who we're told is passionate about God, and in his own kingdom is removing all of these pagan rites. And he makes bedfellows with this guy. What I don't understand why on earth he would do it, and actually we're not told. But it's just to say this. Pastoral leaders are prone to weaknesses too. And maybe actually more pastoral people are prone to certain weaknesses. It looks to me that Jehoshaphat is a man who cares about his people and his nation. And maybe he was roped into caring a bit too much about someone who he should have kept at arm's length. If we unite our families, we'll be friends. Well, it sounds like a really good idea. But the repercussions of that marriage are disastrous in the next few chapters. Ahab's daughter nearly single-handedly wipes out the entire line of David down to one child. If she'd succeeded, no Jesus, because of one marriage. Now, all of us live with the consequences of our actions. Hopefully, none of them are as extreme as that. But as leaders, when we make mistakes, there are consequences to these actions. Jehoshaphat, he returns to God each time. He's rebuked. He's told he's been really wrong, and we see that he comes back to the Lord, and he finishes fairly well. But the warning here is God won't bless godless actions. There's this kind of super spirituality or superstition that can creep into churches that, well, if the Lord is for us, who can be against us? Well, actually, you can be against the Lord and you can be a Christian. Just because you're a church, just because you're a Christian, doesn't mean every idea you have is good. Doesn't mean that everyone who you get involved with you should do, and it doesn't mean that everything that you are involving yourself with is what you should be involving yourself with. It is really easy for Christians to do what Jehoshaphat did and make friends and alliances with the enemy. Now, does this mean you can't shop in Tesco's unless the guy on the checkout is a Christian? No, that isn't what we're being shown here. This isn't about how we relate with non-Christians as Christians. This is about making alliances, big business deals, trades as countries between a country who is supposed to love God, a king who loves God, and someone who is out and out trying to kill his people. So I'm not saying you can only know Christians, only be friends with people in church. That isn't the point. We see that Jesus sends us out into the world. We're supposed to be in the world, but not of it. But Jehoshaphat expected God to bless his godless actions because he was God's king. And this is something that we have to check against as ourselves as Christians. Why would God bless our decisions if they're godless? Why would he honour what we do with our money and our time if it isn't building up his kingdom, but instead detracting people from his kingdom? So Jehoshaphat is passionate. He's personable. He's proactive in creating leaders. He's exceptional in that he manages to shirk off his bad family history. But the shining light is temporary, as actually as he passes, the next king undermines all of his hard work. He was a godly man who occasionally did some silly, godless things. But God loved him and God forgave him because he was passionate for God. So hopefully as leaders, we will be passionate about things which matter to God. We'll be personable. People are the most important thing on this planet. People are the most important thing we have. They're so much more important than things. And we should be available and ready as church and as family. We should be proactive in creating leaders, giving people authority to do God's work, involving others in his kingdom. We should check our family values. Are they in line with where God would have us be? And don't expect God to bless godless decisions. We're going to sing one final song, which is How Great Is Our God. Because ultimately, above every king and above every government, we believe that it is Jesus who rules and decrees.